Hey, comic book collectors, do you want to protect what you collect? Do you hate when your comic books slide around in your short box, or you need to turn them sideways just so they don't bend or fall over? Well, look no further than Sidekick Supplies. Their product fits firmly inside your comic box, so you don't need to worry. And not only is their product made in the USA, but also ships free directly to your doorstop. Check out our sponsor, Sidekick Supplies, at sidekicksupplies.com and use the code COMICCOM15 for 15% off your purchase. Believe me, you'll be ordering more than one.
Welcome to the one and only Comic-Con podcast, your podcast for comic book news, reviews, and comic community drama, with your hosts, Nemesis Prime and Milton the Madman. Are you listening?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whenever you're listening to this. What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the Comic-Con podcast, season 4, episode 8, recording this on February 21st, 2024. We have a very great episode. I think if this is the only episode that you listen to the entire year, I think this is the one to listen to. Right, Zach?
Yeah, this is going to be a good one.
Awesome. So we have... you know, it's been a long week. Last week, of course, we dealt with all the, you know, ongoing drama in the comic book community world. We figured, you know what, let's get back into comics. And I'm really excited to introduce our first time guest on the show. He's an author, editor, co-editor over a dozen books out there, including some titles called A Comics Study Reader back in 2009. We have the Superhero Story in 2013. He's a professor of political science at Marymount Manhattan College over here in New York. So he's close to me since I'm over here in Jersey. But tonight we are actually going to discuss his latest book that just dropped in December called A Cultural History of the Punisher, Marvel Comics and the Politics of Vengeance. We have Professor Kent Worster here with us. Good evening, Kent. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So, I was kind of introduced to Kent by a listener of the podcast, so I really appreciate that. Again, that's the best way. You could always find us at the comiccompodcast@gmail.com if you ever want to send us, you know, people that we should have on here or questions or articles or anything like that. So Kent and I were going back and forth through some conversations, and he offered to send us his latest book. I said, you know what? I said, send it to Zach, because Zach is the, you know, the novelist. He likes reading through everything. If Kent would have sent it to me, it probably would be still sitting in a package, and I would probably get to it at some point after I got done with some video game. But I had him send it to Zach. Zach had a chance to read it. I know he's the big novel guy, so I'm excited to talk about it, to hear what Zach thought, and then just really to get into, you know, Kent's mind of, you know, everything comic book related, and especially his latest talks with the Punisher. So, you know, Kent, give us a little bit of background. Obviously, I kind of gave you some great plugs right there, but, you know, give us a little bit more background as far as, you know, your comic book life, you know, and how you got into everything.
Thanks. It's a good question. I moved to New York in 1983. I'd been living in Cleveland. And, you know, Cleveland was a tough city in 1983, but New York felt even tougher. And I was going to graduate school at Columbia. You know, everything about those first weeks is still memorable, right? I drove in on this beat up Dodge Dart and was worried that my worldly possessions would be stolen out of my trunk every time I stopped at a traffic light. Mm-hmm. And I remember my first semester, another graduate student saying, look, if you take somebody on a date, you should take them back to their apartment door. Don't leave them at the front door of the building because they might get mugged in the elevator. Mm-hmm. And, you know, nobody said anything like that to me in Cleveland. So on the one hand, my graduate studies was focused on political parties and, you know, political ideologies. But daily life was much more connected to questions of crime and safety, and the way in which the politics of the city was changing as a result of the rising murder rate. And so I started getting into comic books, and pretty quickly, early on with the Mike Baron run, the first Unlimited series, I thought, dang, this would make a really interesting, you know, semi-academic, semi-fan-oriented cultural history.
Okay.
that he's not like other characters and that he deserves a certain kind of spotlight.
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting to see, obviously, like comic book fans, right, and the comic book culture, and the comic books are kind of a little derided, right, from people like, oh, these are for children, these are, you know, playthings, toys. People kind of like look down on the comic book culture a little bit, right? But so I always like, it's always extremely interesting when someone takes a very like academic approach towards comics, because there are things to learn there. I mean, this is in and of itself at the beginning, it's storytelling, right? And it's, I mean, that's what honestly history is all about, is storytelling. So was it any different than, you know, classic literature that we had, like the Victorian age literature, to now look at comic books? It's just a different type of literature telling stories, but really reflecting on what's going on in the world. So I don't feel like many people do that. And it honestly kind of feels like, after reading your book, I'm like, it seems like there's a lot of opportunities here for other people to actually kind of like delve into this academic approach to comics and stories, and like you, like the cultural history or some other kind of leaning towards a certain comic book character or title or what have you.
It's a good question. I would suggest that there are things specific to the Punisher, the way in which he's connected to the history of a real city.
Yeah.
Now, his is a selective history, right? His is one that really doesn't pay attention to, for example, the way in which the 70s is the decade of hip hop in New York City, right? There's this, you know, as a young person, I really enjoyed things like the music scene in New York City. But it's undeniable that there was a kind of, the word I use in the book is trauma, and that trauma is reflected in the character. And I don't think we can say that about Blue Beetle or,
right,
you know, most characters. I'm not saying there aren't, you know, important events, tragic events, but I still would suggest that the Punisher, Frank Castle, is a kind of outlier, mm-hmm, in that he doesn't get angry. He is angry, and he's not angry only because of something that happened to his family. He's also angry about something that happened to his city, yeah, and to his world. And I think that makes him different, even from some of the most politically minded independent comics. There's still something, I think, even intrinsic about Frank Castle that makes him an sort of exciting and important chapter or footnote in the history of comics more generally.
Yeah, you know, there was a lot of, I was telling Justin before the show started, when I was kind of giving him some ideas of what I had thought about your book. And I was like, look, a lot of it is like, it's like, I felt like I knew a lot of the points you brought up, but I didn't know them until I read them. And I was like, oh, you're right. Like, okay. And so like, for example, some of the stuff that was very interesting, and look, I've never lived in New York. I've never lived in the East Coast. I currently live in El Paso, Texas. So I'm not as familiar with like the New York scene. And like you said, I mean, Justin and I were born 82, 83. So when you moved out there, that was kind of like we were living in different places. So obviously, but it's so interesting to read about how you wrote about how like New York, and I guess you get it, like with comics, New York is the city, right? Especially for Marvel Comics, it's the city. That's where all the heroes come from. But it does really feel like out of all the characters, New York hasn't affected any Marvel character as much as it did the Punisher. Maybe Daredevil could possibly be there a little bit as well, but it really, in both like how he was written, how he grew in popularity and decline. Like I loved how, so in the book, Kent talks about, you know, the crime rates, obviously during like the 80s and the 90s, how they were just out of this world. And it really, people started to kind of enjoy the Punisher a little bit more, as opposed to the campy writing. You call it trigger happy, the trigger happy earlier versions of Frank Castle. And, people started to kind of feel it more because the crime was there, and you know, this idea of retribution against crime and criminals was very strong and prominent at the time. But then you kind of get into the 90s, right, as you talk about in the book, and it's like things started to kind of turn up for New York, right? The murder rate went down, and Frank Castle's titles, it was almost like he was tied culturally to what was occurring at that time. And so sales for Frank went down as this need for vengeance wasn't really desired by the reader maybe as much. Everyone's kind of living in a happier time, maybe, you know, and so their hearts weren't as like hardened possibly. But it's really very interesting that like he has almost like a microcosm of like what's going on culturally in comics. And I think a lot of it too is the fact that he doesn't have superpowers. You know, I mean, Frank Castle's a regular guy, and the things that happen to Frank Castle are regular things. I mean, tragedy, people, it's easy for someone to understand and relate to the fact that like, you know, hey, crime took my family or a loved one or something like that. It's a little harder to relate to, hey, a gamma radiation bomb exploded and now I turn into a big green monster. So he's very real.
Yeah. Let me piggyback onto that and say that almost everybody who's written about the Punisher, and I'm talking about people on the web as well as, you know, academics, talk about him in terms of his Vietnam experience. Mm-hmm. And that's undeniably important, especially in the hands of Garth Ennis and a couple of other writers.
Right.
But it's striking how few of his stories are about Vietnam or mention Vietnam. And for 10 years or so, he was a Gen Xer whose war experience was the Gulf War of the early 90s. So Vietnam isn't even part of 10 years of his stories.
Yeah.
So what I thought about first was, oh, it's not really about Vietnam. It's about New York City. Then what I realized, and this is the more useful insight, I think, is that Vietnam and New York are two sides of the same coin. That if you're growing up, you know, Frank Castle as a character, you know, it's a little bit, I mean, I'm real, he's fictional, but let's think of him as an early boomer, and I'm at the very end of the boom, right? Mm-hmm. So for somebody who's born, let's say, in 1945, if you're 15 in 1960, New York, the United States, seems just unbelievably full of promise. Mm-hmm. The crime rate is in the low hundreds. The city's growing. Midtown is just, you know, absolutely on a kind of economic tear, right? Buildings are going up and so on and so forth. And liberalism, and I mean this descriptively. I'm not saying pro or con, but the sort of Democratic Party and the people are running New York City, and it's not only Democrats, there are bankers and so on, but the elites who run New York City are kind of optimistic that they can pay high wages, promote unions, provide more benefits, and that corporations will come to New York and they'll pump money into the economy and tourists will come, and that New Yorkers will live better than anybody else in the country. If you like the urban way of life, that's the sort of expectation in 1960. And by 1970, of course, it's all terribly frayed, and by 1975 it is absolutely collapsed. And I think there's a kind of promise that liberal America makes to New Yorkers in the 50s and early 60s that goes sour in the same way that the promise of Vietnam goes sour. Right. And that in some cases it's the very same people.
I can see that.
It's the same mayors, the same senators, same president saying peace in our time, saying we will end poverty. And of course, Frank Castle is an entirely negative and entirely kind of contrarian, just 180 degrees the opposite, like government can never do anything right. And you know, all liberals are wrong about everything they ever say. And so there's an urgency to that character. That's a political urgency. That's not, oh my God, you know, I've been affected by radiation, I've been bitten by a spider, and now I have to be just. No, Frank Castle's anger is a political anger. It starts with politics, and Vietnam and New York City are, like I say, two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, I you know, obviously, yes, we're both younger than you are, Kent. I grew up in New Jersey, but my father worked in New York through the 80s and 90s. He worked sanitation. So he knows, you know, all sides. He's seen all that stuff. I've seen it going into New York City. And for listeners that, you know, have ever experienced New York or think about what New York is like when we've seen it in the movies. Yeah, it looks so bright and beautiful. And, you know, you want to go there. But yeah, there was never that time where, you know, even like when the cleanup, like when Giuliani came in, right? And there's not this political side of the Punisher, even in the 90s, like when they were trying to change from that you know, dingy, grummy New York in the 80s to this 90s cleanup, the Punisher would have been perfect to kind of have as like a backstance in comics, not so much on, you know, in real life, but, you know, to see that political side of the Punisher being, you know, yeah, I'm doing this. I'm helping the cleanup. The politicians are getting involved, but you never saw that. It was never written into the books. And I think that's
right.
The one thing that changes him than anybody else.
It's an interesting point. I mean, in a way, it's a mistake to see him anything other than as part of a machinery of entertainment. And that, you know, writers don't sit down and say, I want to reflect on what's going on in society. I mean, sometimes they do, but sometimes they're reading somebody else's comic and they're like, ooh, I want to do something like this, but better. Or they say, you know, we've done this with the character. Let's do something different because we've beaten this to death. Right. We've had him in New York. Let's put him on vacation. Let's send him to Bahamas. So in other words, the way these comics get produced, these stories get told, is not the same way in which, for example, the political system works. Right? It's not like people giving speeches to get elected. That's not what the Punisher's about. And the fact is, the character, because he is, from what I read, an always angry character, you can have him be angry at all kinds of targets. I mean, you can tell stories about bankers, about corporations, about, you know, dictators in remote countries, about neo-Nazis. He's he kills a surprising number of neo-Nazis.
Yeah.
And I think that's because the writers quite rightly realize that readers don't want a predictable character. And yet, the formula itself is very constrained. And that's, I think, key to understanding the history of the Punisher, is efforts on the part of writers, readers, and editors to do things creatively within this fairly constrained system.
Right. And, you know, it's funny, because we mentioned this like not too long ago, prior to Jason Aaron's, so volume 13, I think we're on volume 14 right now. So Jason Aaron's volume 13 run, and it was at what after, I think it was after Rosenberg's run.
Yeah, yeah.
It was right after all the, which I'm we're going to get into the iconography, ugh, tough word. Of
iconography.
Iconography, thank you. Of like the symbol and all that, we'll get into that as well. So it was right after that kind of ended, there was a lull in Punisher titles at that point. I think Marvel was kind of like, oh, what do we do here? Let's let it cool down a little bit. And then Jason Aaron came in. And we had talked about on the podcast multiple times about, well, how do you make such a character who's really kind of like, look, here's Frank Castle. They murdered his family. It's punishment time. And that's kind of just been, that's who he is. And that's really all, like you said, it's very constrained storytelling. What do you do to make him more interesting? And I loved the Jason Aaron run, where it's like, you know what? Well, let's give him his wife back. And now let's see what happens. And I think that's kind of like, boom. Okay. Whoa. What do we do here? You know, now why are you still so pissed, dude? You know, now you get your wife back. And of course, there was a lot more going on with the hand and whatnot. But the idea of giving him back something that he had lost, it was just so formed him, I thought was awesome idea from Jason Aaron. Really enjoyed that run. And it's tough, like a character like that, you know, how do you make it fresh? How many times can you watch him murder, you know, mob bosses, you know, over and over again, and then not die? So,
I mean, I think one thing we can say is that it is astonishing just how many comics Marvel has managed to squeeze out of this character.
Right.
I never counted exactly how many, and I read 99% of his comics, but it's close to 1,000 in a 50-year period. Now, a lot of those are, you know, his own solo titles, but it's also guest appearances. He's worked pretty well, I think, in guest appearances. I mean, he's enough of an exotic contrarian that you can stick him in, you know, all kinds of titles, including fairly youth-oriented titles, Power Pack and that kind of thing, and Archie, right?
Yeah.
And the Archie comic is way better than it should have been. I'm not saying it's a great comic. I'm not saying it's one of the best comics of that particular year, but it definitely I've read it now more than once, and I never thought, oh my God, this is dreadful. I can't read this. So there's interesting ways in which you can still imagine writers making use of this character, but I don't think we're ever going to return. I hate to make a prediction, but I don't think it's likely we'll return to the day of four or five Punisher titles in a single month, which you have in the early 90s, and which you rightly sort of implied already, is when the murder rate in New York and other big cities is peaking. And so there is some kind of social entertainment connection there. I just don't want to be dogmatic. I mean, I think that somebody could tell a good Punisher story in an era of very low crime, mm-hmm. and readers might connect with it. And I think that you can tell, you know, a Punisher story at a very time of very high crime and not connect with readers because you tell the story badly or because you've told the story too many times.
Right.
So ironically, even though I teach political science and even though I'm interested in sort of the politics of popular culture, I can't stand people who say, oh, Frank Castle is X. He's always, you know, right wing, or he's always, you know, this or that, because writers have some genuine freedom in you using the character how they see fit.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was even a time like when, did you ever read the Thunderbolts series? I know, Zach, I know you.
Sure.
Read it.
Yeah.
The Thunderbolts with like him and Red Hulk.
His most successful romantic relationship apart from his marriage. Yeah.
Wild with the lecture, right?
Yeah.
And it's just,
it's like by far.
Yeah.
Sometimes you need that lull, like you're saying, is he doesn't need a title at that time, so put him in a group. And that series went pretty long from what I recall. I don't remember issue count, but yeah, you don't need a Punisher title at that time. Put him in a group. All these characters can mesh well because we've seen, you know, different incarnations of different teams. And then you bring him back out and he can be somebody different because he's going to be new to somebody, some new reader somehow. And yet you change up the X. But unfortunately, mm-hmm. that's something that, again, like Zach and I have talked about, you know, how do you change him? What was it like about a year and a half ago? And I'm sure you might have read that this article where Jerry Conway came back and said that they wanted to take away the skull. You know, how do you reintroduce him? And Jerry Conway, the creator of the Punisher, said, oh, let's make the Punisher a black militaristic character, war veteran. And it's just like, but why, you know, why can't you just keep that character in the Marvel universe and figure out how to write him better?
Yeah. You know, I think that there is a larger problem, which is that in the 50s, 60s, and through much of the 70s, mainstream comics were being produced for younger readers who were cycling through comics every 5, 7, or 8 years. And you did not have to figure out how to keep a character fresh for readers who were familiar with 40 years worth of titles. Now, for somebody like me, if I go into a comic book store, which I do, you know, once a month or so, I'm much more likely to pick up an old edition, especially if it has something new, a new introduction or a previously unpublished story, right? But in a way, I'd rather spend $30 or $40 on a nice Punisher or Marvel collection than try to keep up with the new stuff and realize that half of what I'm trying to keep up with isn't very good.
Yeah, it seems like the Marvel, the old House of Ideas tend to be running out of some ideas lately, but... it's kind of a decent segue. I'm sure we'll come back to some of the stuff in your book, but we talked about this off scene. So kind of segue into the current Punisher storyline, which I think we're on like issue 3 of. Just moderate spoiler alert for all those who didn't finish Jason Aaron's run. Punisher transports to a different world. And he's kind of just going by Frank Castle now, right? No longer the Punisher.
A different world or a different reality?
I think it's a dimension. Gosh, what dimension is it?
I hate cross-dimensional stories when it comes to Frank Castle.
Yeah,
my view is that if Frank Castle enters something like a transport machine or time thing, that he should just dissolve and say, F you, MFers. You know, he's only interesting when there's something gritty about him.
Right.
Or when it's parody. But to to pretend that he fits in a science fiction environment, I think, is a terrible mistake, or a fantasy environment is a terrible mistake. For example, I don't think he should ever met Doctor Strange. I don't think any of their interactions are convincing.
Yeah, and not to like get away from it, we'll come back to the new Punisher.
Sorry.
No. This is perfect, because you also talk about like the ridiculous stories that Frank Castle had to put up with, like I remember reading Frankencastle, and I was like,
oh, God, mm-hmm. I remember those.
I'm a big X-Men fan. And so, you know, I love Dakin and him showing up. And of course, that little rivalry was awesome when he was a human being. And then
Dakin sucks.
Yeah, he's not great any longer. He was really cool.
I hope I don't lose any readers saying that. You know, I was going to get this guy's book, but.
No. I talk trash on Spider-Man all the time. And he's like the most beloved character.
Yeah, we should talk a lot of good books sometimes.
But Frankencastle, I mean, that was ludicrous. And then what was it? Oh, man, I'm having a mind blank.
Well, just the fact that, look, let's imagine that it's possible to come back to how do I put this? Somebody is in pieces and you put them back together. You sew them back together. Let's say it's possible to reanimate the human body. I believe that science has done that with, you know, sort of lesser creatures, right? Like frogs or whatever. So let's imagine you can do that to human body. What I found impossible is, like, once you're scarred to that degree, how is it that he returns to New York City and he looks like a friggin' model, male model?
And then they just move.
It's like, come on, man. He should have huge Franken scars for years.
Yeah, that was crazy. But yeah, going back to the volume 14. So 3 issues in, there's a new Punisher. His name's Joe Garrison. It's not a very creative idea. He's an ex-SHIELD agent. His family in the first issue blows up in a bomb. He's blamed for the bomb. And now he's hunting down the people who potentially put him in this situation. I know there was a lot of hype. You know, people were looking forward to this. Like prior, there was this whole, hey, there's a new Punisher series and it's going to be a new Punisher. And I've talked to a bunch of buddies who are, you know, Punisher fans, and they're like, wow, this should be kind of cool. But of course, it's Marvel, and I don't know, don't have your hopes up too much. And they kind of just came out with like the most bland storyline. Granted, it's only 3 issues, but they are regurgitating the same storyline. He even has like a microchip-esque like person in the chair. And then in issue 4, I believe that's coming out, is the cover says, who is Jigsaw? And so he's got a new Jigsaw character as well. So time will tell, I guess, to see how Joe Garrison does as the Punisher. Maybe Frank Castle will come back and waste him, which would be kind of cool. But who knows?
Yeah, that's the way
I don't know. So
I have enjoyed several of the stories where Frank Castle deals with other vigilantes.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. Over the last, you know, several decades.
I think one of the storylines that meant the most to me, or like really kind of stood out, because you had all don't get me wrong, the Garth Ennis run and everything is probably like arguably the highlight, right, of Punisher.
But Baron Ennis. That's for me is the kind of axis.
Yeah. I loved the Civil War era when you had the two breakaways. Not saying that's the best. It was something I really loved. You know, you had Cap running this underground team and he's like, hey, the Punisher comes in. The Punisher just like wastes Jack-O-Lantern like right away. And he's like, what have I done?
It's also a period where the characters around him are very well drawn, I think.
Yes.
You know, it's not something I spent enough time on the book, because in a way, a lot of the people write about comics are writing about aesthetics, costumes, different artists and their contributions, and all that's fascinating. But in a way, with the Punisher, while some great artists have worked on the character, I don't think you think of the Punisher as a showcase for comic art.
No, definitely.
I think
Punisher
is a showcase for thriller entertainment, right? Mm-hmm. For hard-boiled vigilante entertainment. Now, when that's drawn well, that's fantastic. But for me, it was the wow, let's step back. Here we have a character who really has slaughtered tens of thousands, and yet he is kind of heroic. Mm-hmm. What world produces such a character?
Right. Yeah.
And that's why the first chapter of the book is not about the character. It's about New York City.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was
in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
And some crazy stories, right? Like, wait a minute, did that really happen? Or did Kent Worcester just make this shit up?
No, it set the tone for your whole book, which I thought was very important. Like you said, you had to paint the picture of New York to show the influence it had on Frank and or on the cultural history of Frank.
And on the readers and the creators, right? Yeah, because definitely. Marvel, almost everybody creating, working on the title, Baron's an exception, but you have to assume, I think, as late as the 90s, most of the people making comics are geographically based.
Right.
That the computer revolution and, you know, the sort of dispersal of talent, I think, is a 21st century phenomenon.
Of course, yeah.
Definitely. And so all those creators are experiencing New York, and they're watching the local news. Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter is, you know, Giuliani gets all this credit, but it's not until Bloomberg that the murder and other violent crime are absolutely kind of coming down mm-hmm. and staying down. That when you look back at crime statistics, it's astonishing how high crime is even when Giuliani leaves office.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lower than it had been. But
yeah, just growing up here, obviously, yeah, you and I are in the same area, just you know, listening to the Fox 5 news and all those, mm-hmm. you know, it was just wild to, you know, you didn't want to go into the city and you got to a point where you could go into the city and a little bit post COVID, you know. It was rough. It was definitely back to those times where, yeah. you know, it was a lot more, and you hear it constantly. Anything in the Bronx, a lot of shootings, a lot of things happening up in, you know, that area in yeah. Harlem and stuff like that.
I'm calling from the Bronx right now.
Oh, well, hopefully there's no gunshots.
Stay safe.
But yeah, you know, that's what it is. Like, I just can't believe that there was a time like that. You know, we were younger, but for the most part, that's we always heard about that, you know, growing up. I constantly heard about that from my dad. And you know, luckily he was safe going into New York. But on the comic book front, none of these characters have ever, you know, the best thing is New York is a real place. And none of these characters, you know, meet again. There's Spider-Man, Fantastic Four, the Avengers, everybody's all in New York. They got Daredevil. And you have the Punisher who still acts in his own way. And can still do it in the means of, you know, a violent way. And I love that about that's the one great thing about the Punisher is that he can be that street level character. I don't know if this was in your book, Kent, but you know, you talked about like the comedic side. Did you ever read when he became Cosmic Ghost Rider?
When they sure. had
that run? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Thoughts on that?
Again, I'm not a fan of the Cosmic Frank.
Yeah.
I like him grounded. And that doesn't mean that he has to stay in New York. You know, there's something enjoyable about seeing an urban character who wears mostly black clothes in places like, you know, Native American reservations mm-hmm. or the jungles of Peru. You know, he probably, like you said, Zach, he probably is a character that you need to sometimes step back.
Yeah.
And sort of let the old kind of creative juices flow for a while before you just insert them. There, you know, part of the story of the book is the story of Marvel itself, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not just that the character has ups and downs. Marvel has ups and downs.
Right. Yeah, for you guys listening, Kent talks a lot about Marvel's like financial woes during like the 90s, the sale of their properties being owned by other companies. I mean, everyone who follows the MCU now all knows how Fox had all their properties because Marvel couldn't afford them and had to sell them. It was a fire sale.
A while, Frank was sort of part of the company strategy mm-hmm. for selling, you know, four times as many comics. And it was a strategy that went bust. Right in the early mid 90s. That's when you get literally those, I don't know, 3 years when you have 2.5 years when you have 5 Punisher titles coming out in the same month. Yeah. One of them is Punisher 2099. Mm-hmm. One of them is Armory, which doesn't even have any story. It's just descriptions and images of guns and knives. Yeah, it was like a handbook,
kind of, yeah.
A handbook for mayhem, 10 issues. And then War Journal, The Punisher, and Warzone,
yeah.
Yeah. That's a lot of Punisher content. And I at the time I was buying it, and frankly, I think I will continue to read The Punisher till I die. But, you know, I have no interest in DC. I have to say that.
Yeah, and
I'm sorry. I don't know why I find DC. I find DC just utterly boring.
What's funny is through your book, you make correlations. And so for those of you listening, pick up Kent's book and check it out. And he talks about influences of both like earlier iterations of this vigilante archetype, but also it's funny how there were so many before Frank. But now if you look back, Frank's the one. Like he has surpassed them and kind of become the one. And he also goes on to talk about some of the DC characters as well that were both before and after Frank, to include, you know, Vigilante. Obviously, this is a Marvel character, but Fool Killer. What were some of the other DC characters that you mean? Peacemaker. All kind of like from the arc, even Deathstroke to some extent, Deadshot to some extent. I mean, they're all somewhat, either whether they're before or after Frank, they are influenced by Frank Castle. Because I think he, and you mentioned this a lot in your book, like, I mean, look, I mean, you think about how he was introduced, right? He's introduced an Amazing Spider-Man, which you look at the three, in my opinion, the three New York characters, get rid of Fantastic Four, Avengers, X-Men, all them. You look at Daredevil, Spider-Man, and probably Frank Castle, the most like strong connections to New York, right? And those are all three completely different New Yorks. So you almost feel like they're in alternate universes in some aspect. And so Frank being introduced in Spider-Man in like the glorious, glowing, bright lights New York, the Marvel Universe, it's a joke. And he's what, like you said in the book, the assassin is how he's titled on the cover issue. And they didn't know what they had. And it just kind of like took off.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy.
Yeah. Some listeners will, of course, know about The Executioner, right? Yeah. Mac Bolan. The Executioner arrives in 1969. And he really is one of the earliest of the kind of angry Vietnam vets. There are a couple from earlier, but boy, 69 is very early for that kind of what we think of as a very 70s phenomenon. Right. The bringing the war back home, Rambo and all that. Right. Yeah. You know, get rid of your beard, hippie. And it's like, hey, you're talking to an angry special forces vet. You know, this is no ordinary drifter. So Frank Castle arrives in 74. And the terrible irony is that if you're in Hollywood now and you're talking about what to do with the Executioner, people will say to you, how do we distinguish this character from the Punisher?
Right.
Which is so painful since the Executioner is so much part of the Punisher's DNA.
Yeah. Sometimes sometimes the guys overtake the best, right? You know, you had Pistol Pete and then Michael Jordan showed up. I don't know.
And you do have this interesting cultural phenomenon where one representative example becomes remembered as a stand-in for an entire mini-genre or an entire moment, right? So we're not talking much about sort of 60s English pop music, but the Beatles, right? Herman's Hermits, Dave Clark Five. No, it's all the Beatles.
Yeah.
And the same, I think, is true with the Vigilante, that in a way, no one could have predicted that in 2024, a Punisher, T-shirt or a shoulder patch is a kind of political symbol. It's not, you're not saying you're part of the comic book world. I mean, you might be, but much more likely is you're saying, you know, you are prepared, at least in your head, to deal with your enemies.
Yeah.
I think it's a political symbol now.
And I honestly think if you think about Marvel and their symbols, I mean, name a more distinctive or influential symbol that Marvel has besides the Punisher Chevron. You know,
and how out of its control it is, right? So the Hulk is very evocative, let's say, of anger, right? And a lot of 5-year-olds or 8-year-olds will gravitate to a Hulk image, right? They'll be like, "Ooh, Hulk hands," or "Ooh, that's a cool Hulk T-shirt."
Hulk smash,
but all of those representations are copyright protected, whereas easily half of what gets sold under the Punisher-esque rubric is unofficial, unlicensed. You know, you cannot trademark a skull per se. And once you're adding blue lines to a black and white skull, you have a sort of Blue Lives Matter Punisher image without interfering with trademark.
Yeah.
Or at least you're in gray area.
Right. And or so many something where it's not worth the battle for
Marvel. Exactly. Yeah. And some of these producers are outside the United States. Some of them are very small. You're on Etsy, right? You're producing. Yeah. And I don't have any sort of inside information on Marvel, but I think that they must be vexed with how do we make money from a character who has become so much part
for sure,
of the wider culture in the way that, say, Robin Hood is or Sherlock Holmes.
But neither one of those characters have
a generic symbol.
And neither one of those characters have a symbol. You know, there's no
right.
Nothing flashes in front of your face and you're like Robin Hood. Maybe an arrow. Right. Maybe an arrow. But but you see the Punisher skull and you're like, oh, that's the Punisher.
Yeah. So obviously I think Marvel would go after somebody who printed a t-shirt with, say, a panel from a comic book.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of what you see in the culture is very difficult for Marvel. And I think that's one reason why we've had a drop off in Punisher titles in the last few years, because, you know, the ideological echo effect or the ideological kind of charge that the character issues is just so powerful.
Yeah, you can definitely see this character being his popularity coming on a pendulum, right? As the ideological winds in the United States shift, right? So whether we're
to interrupt. I mean, it's just Marvel doesn't want a character where half the audience is like, you sell that? You know, how could you endorse that?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I thought about this, especially in writing the conclusion, is that clearly some degree of controversy is very good for Marvel. Mm-hmm. Right. You don't want to just produce comics that the fans enjoy, but that don't have the occasional whatever, like you killed off a character or there's a female Spider-Man or whatever the controversy is.
Yeah.
But I think when you had that march to the Unite the Right in 2019, where people were chanting some very outrageous slogans, you know, certain people will not replace us. Right. And you look at photographs and you're seeing all those Punisher symbols where people are have those tiki flame things in the air and a night march.
Yeah, it was a bad look for Marvel.
It was a very tough situation, and I think that helps explain why they sent him in this trans-dimensional direction.
And I'm not like, and Justin and I talk about this a lot, and of course you can say these things and it's going to happen, especially as I read your book. I'm more like aware now of like, okay, politics and comics, you know, most of us reading comics like, man, I don't really need your politics and comics. But they're there.
Fair enough.
They're always there, right? Like, I mean, even as an X-Men fan, I know that X-Men revolve around politics. But there was something in the Rosenberg run that I loved. And it was, I couldn't tell you verbatim what it was, but police car rolls up. They got the Punisher skull on the back. And Punisher, like, straights up, like, synopsis of what he says, more or less. He says, you're not me. You're supposed to be better than me. And if you do anything, I'm going to turn on you type situation. Mm-hmm. Where he didn't. Mm-hmm. He's like, I don't approve of this. Don't be like me. I'm not a hero. Like, I'm not the guy. And you're supposed to be better than this. And I don't want to see you flaunting that anymore. And I thought that was very, like, strong. It was a strong point, and it's the truth. Like, yes, you know, we all have those moments where you're like, oh, take out the bad guy. You know, get him, kill him, whatever. But that's not I think in our heart of hearts, we all know that's not justice. But you do have the weakness of being human where you get that way. And the Punisher's that guy that let him do it. You know, we don't need our law enforcement to be like reflecting that.
Listen, I still think there's good Punisher stories to be told from the point of view of police officers.
Like interactions with them would be really
good. His interactions and also a story where he's a minor character.
Yeah.
I mean, they did that in a way with Code of Honor about 20 years ago. A limited series where the Punisher was a sort of fringe character in the third issue, if I remember rightly, 304. I also think he works well with conspiracies.
Yeah.
Because I think this is a character who wants to be simple-minded in a way, right? He's not just single-minded. He wants to be able to see things in black and white. I mean, think about how his costume, especially in this first iteration, is black and white.
Yeah.
right? There's no nuance. There's no gray. And even his boots are white. Truly an idiotic 70s look. White right? Because, you know, right? White gloves. You go out in dark time, you know, nighttime, you know, and you're, ooh, spooky man with white boots.
All that blood, too? That's going to get all over your nice white boots.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, but there's room for him to... I'd like to see a Punisher on the road situation, too. Like, take him out of New York. Move him into... you know, different cities throughout the U.S. and dealing with different problems, right? You know, you could, I know, and you mentioned in your book at the end, who was it? One of the most recent authors of The Punisher was talking about if he wrote something in the future, he could see it occurring on the border.
Mike Baron,
yeah.
Yeah,
dealing
yeah.
with situations down there with cartel or, you know, the human smuggling aspect and things like that. I mean, those are all interesting stories. And it's a more nuanced crime than the mobster and the thug. The taxi cab driver.
I think people probably got where I was going with the conspiracy stuff, which is that you have this character who's simple and that you can have conspiracies that are quite opaque, right? With people with, you know, complicated motives. And that's an interesting kind of juxtaposition, right? You know, I don't want to know all this. Just tell me something as he points the gun at the guy. He's like, no, you don't understand. It's way more complicated than you think. I have a soft spot for that kind of storytelling.
Yeah, it would be interesting.
Yeah, but...
Ken, you know, obviously please. You're a huge Punisher fan and you've read a lot. Like, why, in your mind, why haven't they taken him out of New York? Like Zach's saying, like, currently you could do like a border thing, Texas, New Mexico... you could bring him to the South. You could bring him out West. You know, why don't you think Marvel wants to bring him out of New York with so many superheroes?
I'm not, I don't know this for a fact, but my assumption is that the extra dimensional magical side of the MU is appealing for a editorial leadership that wants to depoliticize the character. And that in a way, what you're saying is why not, you know, lean into that, you know, I guess what I'm saying is slightly metaphysical, right? What I'm saying is that this is a character who's always political, that the trauma of the 70s is kind of buried in his DNA, right? And that if you decide to tell non-political Punisher stories as far removed from any kind of possible political theme as possible, as imaginable, such as an alternative dimension, right? Where
Frankencastle, right?
Yeah, or Frankencastle. Yeah. It's like, ooh, you know, you don't need any political lens to think about Frankencastle. That's just a slice of entertainment cheese being served piping hot or freezing cold or something. But you know, I think it's fair for readers to be ambivalent about a character who is so intensely political. And I sympathized with all those letter writers in the 90s who said, you know, enough with the drug dealer murders or enough with this character. Or why are you publishing 4 issues? So I think even readers who love the Punisher must have a love-hate relationship with the character.
Yeah.
Because he's so frigging relentless.
Yeah, yeah. So out of all the adaptations, obviously you talk about, Kent goes on and talks about like the adaptations of both, you know, cinematic and obviously the Netflix Punisher. I mean, there's really only one good answer of like what the best one is, obviously the John Bernthal stuff, but.
It's Dolph Lundgren, of course.
Dolph Lundgren.
Yeah, Dolph what is it, Swedish mile?
When he kills like 100 ninjas in a room, it's just absurd.
Why God?
I like, talking about like the moving aspect, like I liked the idea of having like I'm a big fan of the Thomas Jane movie, and not to say that it's great, you know, cinema by any means, but I really enjoyed it. I love the merger of the characters.
I love Ennis's characters. I love the side characters.
Yeah, it was great. But I love that it was in Tampa. Not that I'm like a Tampa fan or anything, but like it's in Tampa Bay. It wasn't in New York. It had a different feel to it. There was something, it was a little bit more grounded. I liked the FBI thing, the family getting killed at the the family
reunion. Yeah, island. Scene.
Yeah.
It's a gruesome in Puerto Rico, I think.
Yeah.
I just didn't ever bought that this person would have embarked at the end of the movie on a permanent campaign of violence.
Yeah.
It seemed I never really bought Thomas Jane. Exactly. I felt like this is fundamentally a psychologically healthy person who went through an extremely damaging, horrifically damaging event and who needed to, you know, purge.
Right.
Right. Who needed a bloodletting in order to become whole again. And so to me, that's the character Thomas Jane played. What I'm looking for, I agree with you about John Bernthal. He is obviously the best of them. But what I'm looking for is somebody to do the Punisher in the way that Kiefer Sutherland has done Jack Bauer. And I have to say, as a Jack Bauer fan, there are times where I believe Jack Bauer or Kiefer Sutherland achieved a kind of synthesis between him and the character and the reality they were living in, right? The world building. At a level that I don't even think Bernthal has achieved.
Yeah. Are you looking forward to the Daredevil Born Again series coming out with Bernthal's
Sure, of return? Course.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, if it's interesting, what I figured out is that I am basically a fan of print when it comes to a character like the Punisher. Because print gives you by far the greatest opportunity for unexpected craziness of all kinds, delightful or terrible.
Yeah.
That print is where you have Mark Miller's story where the politically correct Punisher is dying and he says bullets going through my body like butter, but some people can't afford butter. Yeah. They can only afford margarine. And it's like, how would you come up with that? And
Mark Miller's gold. He's gold.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that with print, you can have, you know, an excessively politically correct version, and you can have this very far right version that you get with the Edmondson run. But with streaming, of course, there's a kind of tightening of that ideological presentation. There's a kind of narrowing, and it's not that I want one kind of Punisher story. What I love are the Punisher stories that I don't expect. And so the Netflix series are okay, and Bernthal in particular works very hard, and some of the action scenes are really well put together, but I'm still struck by that ideological narrowing. And I'll tell you, once people put patches on their shoulders or they have a Punisher symbol on their shirt, then I think the ideological narrowing is complete. And there's only one thing the character says. But I prefer the 50 years of print history where the Punisher's done some nutsy things and trying to make the whole history work as a single story becomes like insanely difficult. Like, you know, what is, and in a way it's like, what is this company that's putting out these crazy comics and who are we to be reading them?
Yeah.
Like Frank Castle.
I mean, the Punisher will return. I think in terms of Frank Castle, the Jason Aaron run ended with Maria being pregnant. So that lends another, you know, kind of nuance to the character.
I say let her dead. Seriously. I'm afraid, Zach, you and I disagree.
I'm not saying I want her back. I just liked the idea of here's a change to the character and we can change his dynamic and throw a wrench into, like, obviously, I think I would have preferred the story if it didn't have so much supernatural with like the hand, because I think that took away from that aspect. It would have been more interesting if he was just the Punisher, no supernatural. And, you know, obviously something supernatural had to happen with his wife coming back from the dead. But, hey, man, here's your wife back. And now what are you going to do? Are you going to continue being the Punisher? Because the other thing that was really interesting about Jason Aaron's run was he went back and changed canon. I mean, he kind of like showed you, look, their marriage was not good.
Bastard.
Yeah. And it was getting ready to, like, he was killing people as a little kid. He was, you know, being, and obviously that's a little bit more of the supernatural stuff.
Right. Too. 8-year-old psycho.
Yeah.
No, I much prefer Garth Ennis's backstory, to be honest.
Yeah. I did like the change though with his marriage with Maria. Like I liked how it showed it wasn't this, like, his Frank Castle, just the perfect marriage, perfect family, my family gets taken from me. And that's not the truth, right? Like, at least
Jason
Aaron's truth. And
even Maria was going to leave him, which was very interesting. So,
I mean, what we're pointing to is that deep in the mythos of the character is a boomer story, mm-hmm. right? That this is somebody who grew up in a prosperous America. His father, Garth Ennis's version, is his father's a unionized guy at Brooklyn Navy Yard. And, you know, he's paying, he can afford a family, buy a house in Queens on a working class, you know, high school salary, right? Doesn't go to college and the wife doesn't have to work. And that America kind of crumbles, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's a powerful story. And I think it is ultimately, I think to tell a good Punisher story, you have to think about the character. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's ironic, right? Because there's not a lot there. It's a cipher, right? His family's dead. Now he's angry. You know, he's got guns. But on the other hand, it's like, well, wait a minute. Where are we in time? What's the other source of his anger? You know, obviously the family is crucial, but if you just keep killing, you can't just be angry about your wife and family.
Yeah. I think,
and so then you're talking about the world around him.
Yeah. I definitely think he's a character. No, at all. I apologize. I think he's a character that will last for a really long time. I think you can go, I mean, this is all assuming, right? Marvel's still making comics in next 100, 200 years or whatever, but you have I think about a character like Frank Castle, you know, it's a Vietnam, right? And then it was the Gulf War. And then I think even in Bernthal, it was obviously Iraq, Afghanistan. I think more Afghanistan, his storyline over there. And then I look at characters like Magneto, right? Who was entrenched in World War II. And like, as you get further years away from World War II,
A tricky one for them, isn't it?
How do you fix that? So the Punisher, unfortunately, the world, humans are going to be humans and continue to go to war. We're going to have a new reset, a new background provided for Frank Castle in 20 years and 30 years. And it'll be a new one and a new one. And just the fact that he's the trauma and the core, it's so human. It's so human, that feeling of revenge and betrayal of society and the world in general. I think it's something people will always, unfortunately, love.
Can I throw out one kind of connected thought to this,
and then
maybe promote the book and kind of wrap it up? I'll share something with you that I think is interesting, which is that when I was growing up, not only myself but everybody I knew thought, God dang it, we missed everything. Was cool 10 years ago. We were too young for Woodstock, right? Back then, you know, we were so much more aware of the financial, right, more austerity, the arrival of sexually transmitted diseases, and that idea that the late 60s for a young person was a time of just unparalleled opportunity. And I sort of grew up assuming that what was true for me and my friends would also be true for everybody who came afterwards, which was, man, all we're going to do for the rest of my life is talk about the 60s. And in fact, it's the opposite. All we do now is talk about the 70s, right? My students are much more interested in the 70s than they are in the 60s.
Yeah.
And I think our culture, if you look at the kind of politics of Donald Trump, I don't think the 60s help explain Donald Trump at all. I think the 70s help explain Donald Trump. Right? Because some of his anger is the same as Frank Castle's. Mm-hmm. That sense of betrayal, you know, we were promised flying cars, you know, we were promised this and that. And, you know, we have these dirty airports, and which is one of his pet themes, right? And our showers don't give us enough water. So I think you're right that Frank Castle is a character who's sometimes difficult to use well, but has a kind of surprising tenacity. And I suspect part of the answer to that is that the 70s matter to us almost more than any other decade from the past. That in a way, it's the sort of shadow, right? It's what we want to avoid. Mm-hmm. That degree of unease and of, urban decay.
Yeah. Oh, that's a very good point. I'm a little too youngish. I'm definitely not young, but like I don't the '70s. I mean, I rarely think about it besides like history and stuff. And
but let's put it this way: if somebody was having an actor you like was coming out with a new movie, and it was set in the '60s and it's optimistic, or it was set in the '70s and it's pessimistic, which would you be drawn toward?
I don't know.
I'm in more sixties.
I don't know. Really? It would depend. Okay. I guess it would depend on more than just those two, like fair genres. Enough. Yeah.
It also depends on where you grew up and how you see the world. You know, like again, you've grown up, I guess, like you said. Since have you been in New York since the '80s? Since you,
yeah.
So you know, you've grown on this East Coast. Everyone's a little different. I think some people would enjoy seeing certain things from the '60s because of where they are in their culture, in their economics. I think it's a little different. I think you and I get what you're saying.
It is. Let's just put it this way. It is powerful. It is striking how many powerful images come to our mind when we hear the phrase the '70s or the urban crisis.
Very true.
And it's very straightforward to plop Frank Castle into that narrative, right? Yeah. It's the '70s and here is Frank Castle.
Yeah.
And you've already built a world. Yeah. And I guess what I'm saying is having been a kid in that period, it never occurred to me that anybody would want to ever return to that world. And I remember walking through thinking, man, where's the '60s?
Well,
yeah.
Kent, we seriously, I know Mr. Zach over there. Literally.
Right. You're never going to have me again. I understand.
No, I hope.
I keep talking.
Yeah. But we want to wrap this up for you. Professor Kent Worster, you can find his book, again, the name of the book that just came out the end of last year, A Cultural History of the Punisher, Marvel Comics, and the Politics of Vengeance. Kent, you know, where can people find the book? Where can people get the book and or, you know, follow you?
Forbidden Planet had a few cheap copies. I'll be signing copies at Barnes & Noble on the east side at 87th and 3rd Avenue on a week from today, tonight, Wednesday, February 28th between 5 and 6. And I'll be signing copies at Mocha Fest in mid-March at somewhere in Midtown.
Mocha Fest
is the annual independent comics festival in New York City.
Oh, I'm going to have to check that out.
You'll know about that, Justin?
Yes.
Dude, I can't know everything. Every comic show.
All of them, man.
Well, you know, last week we were talking cattle. 2 weeks ago, we were talking about CattleCon, which is another story. But Mocha Fest, I'm gonna have to look up with this Mocha Fest. And yes, obviously, I'm in New Jersey, so okay.
Good.
So,
hope to see you there. Thank you again.
Yes,
and yeah, good luck with the show.
Thank you. Thank good you luck. Have a great night. Take care, Kent. All right.
That was great,
Zach. That was good stuff.
Yeah.
You were very very astute since you actually had the book. Fortunately, I couldn't chime in too much, but
no, I can mail it back to you so you can take a read.
Yeah, definitely. Mail it to me. I'll definitely check it out, obviously.
Yeah.
It sounds very interesting. And again, that's the one thing that we've always spoken about. The Punisher is a type of character who does transcend that timeline that the majority of us readers, you know, old time readers have been dealt with. And I think what you said too about, you know, obviously the Punisher never really did anything with, like, they didn't really introduce him anything going with like the Gulf War. Obviously with Bernthal, it's more of what the Iraq
type thing. Iraq, Afghanistan, I believe.
Yeah, but it's all, yeah, so it's all over.
I can't remember which one.
Yeah, we really don't get too much. At some point we're going to have something, and you know, will they ever get to the point where the Punisher dealt with Osama bin Laden or something? Again, the Punisher can't continue to do this. Magneto can't be continuing in the Holocaust.
Right. It's not going to work.
Yeah. So,
you know, I always think about, honestly, kind of one of the first big quote unquote controversial topics we talked about on the podcast was the Punisher, when they were talking about pulling the Punisher emblem during the Rosenberg run. And when Jerry Conway came out and made his comments about the character. So it was really fun to read this book and kind of like dive into it a little bit. Cause I will always kind of think about our first season on the podcast with that when I think about the Punisher, like symbol stuff.
I mean, and he just obviously with the con, you know, the most recent Joe Garrison, you know, that's,
yeah,
there's just so much that is a new, he's a newer character, and having the Punisher for 50 years, right?
You know, right.
There's so much politics behind it that it's just like, how come they haven't changed him?
Yeah, 50th year. This is going to be his 50th year anniversary this year.
Yeah, him and a lot of other characters.
Well, hell, it's now February. February, yeah. 1974 was when ASM 129 came out. I'm surprised they didn't do anything.
See, they don't care. They care more for Wolverine. I think
they're real careful, man. I think they're just real careful because they realize, like, dang it, people really love this character. We can't get rid of him. Even if I'm not saying they want to, but they just don't know what to do with him because, you know, like Kent said, I mean, he's a bit of a firebrand, you know, like he kind of is polarizing for sure. It's very interesting. It's kind of telling, man. I'm thinking about it now. It's very telling they didn't do a 50th anniversary or some kind of like a legacy issue. Like, why didn't Punisher come out this issue, whatever, in the month of February as a legacy issue with like Kent said, maybe like 1,000, whatever it would have been. That's kind of wild.
Yeah. I mean, the shit, they're doing it for everybody else, right? Wolverine's getting his... When they do those theme months where
yeah.
that character appears on one variant of every title or 20 out of 20 titles, but
yeah,
how come you don't have that? So
yeah,
that's really interesting. All right, so let's finish up with some comic book reads before we get out of here. You want to start us off?
Go ahead. Let me collect my thoughts.
All right then. So speaking of, no, I don't sure really do this Punisher. No, he's not really the Punisher, but we'll go with the latest. Season or series, yeah, I should say series because they're limited series of Predator Last Hunt just came out. Number one, I'm nice. Really enjoying the Predator stuff.
I'm glad you liked it. I wasn't sure if I was going to read it, and I wanted to hear what you're going to say. Great.
So, did you read it?
No.
Oh, okay. So, you know, so it's, I like how they're, how Marvel kind of got the rights tomorrow to both Predator and Alien. This is the third series in this. So, the first one was just called The Predator, the last one was called like The Purge, Predator The Purge. And this is the Last Hunt. So it's, again, it's continuing on those last two series. So everything is intertwined. And I like how they're keeping it short, you know, four or five issues. It, you know, still reverts back to Tifa, the main character from the first one. Obviously, what's great about the storyline, too, is even on like the opening panel, they talk about in 1987, the Predator appeared in the jungle and only one survived. In 1989, you know, the Predator 2. And then they do the 2010 Adrian Brody movie. And then it skips so many, it's like skips like 30 years or no, then it's like 7 years later where they found the, which was the Predator, that other movie, that was the terrible movie. Oh, yeah. And everything's intertwined with the movies. And then it's like 30 years later. So it's now like the 2050 was like when that first series started, but every series has jumps ahead a little bit, just not too much, but it's still all about this girl trying to hunt down these predators. So, but at this point, in the previous series, she picked up a character named Paolo. In this series, which is now 3 years after the last series, it's her and this other character, Paolo, who are trying to find out again, like, where are they? They come across a downed ship, and they find that, you know, this is something that we learned in the previous series with the characters. They herd them like cattle. They freeze them, mm-hmm. and then they send them out into, like, those hunting parties where it's similar to the Adrian Brody movie where they let them, kind of like a big game type of movie. So
yeah.
They're trying to find out because nobody knows where the Predator's home planet is. They're trying to find out where they're hurting other people because the ship that they find can't be all the people. So I'm enjoying the series. I loved all the first two volumes. I think this third volume is going to wrap up and then they're going to have to do something different. So definitely one of my good picks of the week, Predator 1 Last Hunt. Another title that I, you know, we talked about this probably a few months ago when they announced it, The Edge of Spider-Verse number one. Of course, we talked about them introducing new first appearance of characters. So this one introduces Weapon 8, which is basically like a Weapon X project Spider-Man. Did you read this one?
No, how was it?
Okay, let me tell you there. And I don't care. I'm spoiling this one. So literally right in the beginning, the whole half the story is him fighting Wolverine.
Is it
trying to find out about himself?
Is it modern continuity or is it an alternate universe?
It's definitely not because Edge of Spider-Verse has always been a different Okay. It's not continuity because literally he's fighting an escaped Weapon X, and basically the way he kills him, it's just it's so badass. That's all I'm going to say is he kills him. And
okay.
I'll show it to you later or whatever. But then he has to hunt down Cap. And the whole thing is him trying to find out as being a person. Because, you know, like Weapon X is Logan's, like he doesn't know who he is once he becomes Weapon X. And that's mm-hmm. the whole idea of this issue is him trying to find his name. And then you find out who he is by the end of the issue. And of course, he's going to continue because that's never the end of the Spider-Verse. So there's three stories. That's one of the stories. The second story involves Spider-Bite. I couldn't care less. She's just a weird character. She's fighting in digital space. She's fighting like the Shocker and some other character in digital space, makes no sense. And then the third one involves Miguel O'Hara, Spider-Man 2099, and Madame Web. Oh, God. Can't believe she showed up in a book. But her trying to get this Spider Society together to fight some new beings that are coming. And it's setting up. There's like a Web of Spider-Man one-shot that's coming. And then there's going to be like this Spider Society book or something else, like a, kind of like a Web Warriors thing. But this is actually a pretty good thing. So if you're reading the book at the very end, they talk about introducing new spider characters, and the Spider-Woman from the Across the Spider-Verse is going to be introduced in one of these issues. So if you want the first appearance of that version of that character, you should be picking up this series, because I'm sure that's probably a book that I would say maybe retain some value because of the fact that she's been in the movies. She'll be in two movies. And then, you know, you'll have a comic book appearance because we know from, you know, it's not the, was it Jessica Drew, right?
It's Jessica Drew, just the alternate version.
Yeah, so like this version of Jessica Drew is going to be in this upcoming comic. I mean, there's so many titles, literally there's so many titles this week to read. I don't want to go through everything. I'll just pick one more. Titans number 8.
Oh, I read that one too.
You know, this is why I have a love-hate relationship with Tom Taylor, because there's times where he's very good at writing, and then there's times I'm just like, I just can't stand it. This is coming off the heels of the Beast World. And, you know, Garth is, you know, hated for what he did. If you haven't read the Beast World stuff, basically he was the one that kind of made everybody turn into animals because of some virus. At the end of Beast World as well, you find out that the villain is Dr. Hate, but the Dr. Hate is the evil version of Rachel, who's Raven. And you find out in this issue that the evil version of Raven is actually now taking over, and the good version of Raven is trapped inside her little amulet in her head. So some really interesting stuff that's going to be happening, because you're going to see the Titans crumble from within, I think, as Raven kind of does whatever she's going to do, especially with Trigon. And it's really weird because this Titan started off strong and then it dipped. And now I'm excited to read it again.
I agree.
And it's,
I was almost going to give it up. I was almost,
yeah, but it's like this, and it's always the same, and it's the same writer. So it's like, how do you just kind of have that? Like,
I think events, dude, I think events kind of, like, I was turned off by the Beast World stuff. You know what also annoys me about the Titans? Like, when is Tempest just going to join the team? Like, it's, I actually like the character of Tempest. And even in this issue, it's like, oh, we got some help here. And here comes Tempest. But you know, he's not going to be part of the team. And it was like that in the Titan show. You barely got any Tempest. And it's like, dude, just put the dude on the team already, man. Like, shit's annoying. But
I had to. And then I'll just pick one more. I'll pick of the week, Ultimate Spider-Man 2. I, you know, what's funny, this is kind of goes back to Miles Morales, right? Like, so Ultimate Fallout 4 is his first appearance. And then, you know, people love that Ultimate Spider-Man, like number 4, number 5, because that's the first time he's called Spider-Man or something like that. Right. It's like him on the, or he gets his, like the new costume. He gets like his more normal costume, and he's actually called Spider-Man. And I feel like that's the same thing here, is like that first issue, he's still not Spider-Man. It's not the first appearance of Peter Parker, and everybody went nuts because I guess it's really an Ultimate Invasion. And he's still in this issue, he's still not really Spider-Man because he still doesn't know who he is. And I like that because it's like an older version of how Peter Parker would act, right? Mm-hmm. Like with Shocker, who's in there. And again, you see what's going on with Fisk, and the Green Goblin kind of shows up a little bit. But I do like this older version of Peter, because now it's, It's a 20-year-old, you know, because he says it somewhere in the comic where he's like, you know, if you do what you should have been doing 20 years ago, do you act like you would have acted 20 years ago with right. abilities? And I like his suit. Like, it's almost like the Venom suit, but not, right? It's almost more of like Tony's suit from Avengers Infinity War, right?
Mm-hmm.
How he kind of like disappears and kind of comes back.
Yeah.
And then just the whole family aspect. It's just something different that we haven't seen from the Peter Parker world. So that's definitely pick of the week was Ultimate Spider-Man. So what about you?
I had a couple ones, some honorable mentions. I've been reading the Hunger in the Dusk. It's an image book by G. Willow Wilson, and it's pretty cool. It's issue 6. It's kind of like the end of this first arc. It's supposed to come back, I think, in the summertime, and it's in obviously a different world. It's orcs kind of versus humans, but it's not like what your typical orcs versus humans are. It's not like, you know, like Warcraft type situation. They're both like struggling. One has grassland, one has animals, and they trying to figure out how to survive, but also warring against each other for land. But then here comes a new villain that's kind of uniting them or forcing them to unite. So it's been a really good read. I've loved the character development that they've done in it, and it's 6 issues. I really suggest if you're looking for something new, something kind of fun and different, you know, that if you're into that kind of like fantasy thing, check it out, The Hunger in the Dusk. What else? Rogue Son, number 18. I've talked about Massiverse a lot, you know, on the show, and I'm not saying this is like the pinnacle of comic book writing by any means, but like the Radiant Black stuff, but I've really enjoyed Rogue Son. I think it feels like a 90s comic, man. It's got great characters. They're flashy. The art's great. It's really cool. And it's also kind of like, it's stopping here for a little bit. I think it also comes back in the summer. I might be messing up the dates on the, like, confusing the two, but it's taking a little hiatus for a little bit. So 18 issues in, Rogue Son, check it out. You don't have to read the rest of the Massiverse to like understand it or anything like that. It's not needed, but it's really cool. Supernatural, New Orleans. I don't know how to explain it, man. It's awesome. It's really, really cool. I finally got to read issue 3 of The Bloody Dozen. I always talk about the Shrouded College. It's so awesome. It's so cool. I finally get to meet the vampires up on this like space station. Like, this is the most wild idea in the world.
Yeah, I saw it. I have to read it. I saw it today.
But it's so good, dude. Like, I just think it's so fun. Like, hey, let's do a comic. Let's put some vampires in space near the sun and have people prison break them. Like, I mean, yes, sign me up, dude. But I mean, other than that, there wasn't a really strong title that stood out to me this week. I don't think so. I enjoyed the Star Wars. I enjoyed the Star Wars book.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed Cobra Commander number 2.
Yeah, that was another one. I literally could. There's so much. There was a lot of stuff to talk about.
Yeah, I didn't feel like any of them were like amazing, but I love you finally get the green Kyber crystal was cool, and then the Cobra Commander stuff. I mean, all the Energon stuff. I'm really enjoying. So
I'm wondering if the Sith girl from Star Wars in these issues is going to have, she's going to appear like in High Republic or something older. Mm-hmm. So, like, she's going to be a character that people should be like picking up her appearances.
Maybe
because she doesn't. Because even when Luke comes out of that you know trance or whatever, he goes, "Oh, what I was looking for is older than what I need. You know what I'm looking, what I need."
Yeah.
So she's very far back in the world of the Sith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought it was a good issue, but that's it, man. Kind of a long episode today, but it was a good one.
Yeah. And you were speaking about vampires, and obviously I had to very quickly pull this up. So make sure you follow, of course, our buddy V. Ken Marion,
yes,
who we will be bringing to King Kong as well as Terrificon. Check out over on Instagram, V. Ken Marion, and also follow Neon Frontier Studios for his upcoming project called Battle Chronicle Soul Striker. And there is a villain, his villain, the Vampire King of Rolok. Fucking awesome.
Looks awesome.
Very cool. Yeah. Very cool 90s, 2000s anime video game vibes. There's several different characters. If you go and check out
his feeling story. Legacy of Kain, man, when I saw it too, I was like, oh gosh, it's awesome.
Yeah. So there's definitely some stuff going on. You can go ahead and the Kickstarter hasn't started, but you can go ahead and start following it. So please go check out our buddy V. Ken Marion over on Instagram or on X. anywhere else. And also Neon Frontier Studios is also where it's going to be coming, but it'll be on the Kickstarter soon. So yeah, that's all we got this week. Upcoming, again, we will do have some stuff for King Kong other than bringing Ken along. We will be set up there. Zach is coming. And then we may have an exclusive.
Secret.
That out there. So that's it. Follow us on all our socials. Please check out, again, make sure you go check out Kent's book, A Cultural History of the Punisher, Marvel Comics, and the Politics of Vengeance. You can go ahead and buy it. And then again, you're here on the East Coast in New York, and you want to go see him next week on the 28th over at Barnes & Noble's. So go check that out. That's it for this week's episode. Appreciate everybody listening, and we'll catch you all in next week. Hey, comic book collectors. Do you want to protect what you collect? Do you hate when your comic books slide around in your short box, or you need to turn them sideways just so they don't bend or fall over? Well, look no further than Sidekick Supplies. Their product fits firmly inside your comic box, so you don't need to worry. And not only is their product made in the USA, but also ships free directly to your doorstop. Check out our sponsor, Sidekick Supplies, at sidekicksupplies.com, and use the code COMICCOM15 for 15% off your purchase. Believe me, you'll be ordering more than one.